am Sherry Malkolik.
Hi, Sherry.
My sobriety is March 14th of 2001. I have a sponsor and a home group, and I want to thank Billy for asking me to come out again. I think that means I didn't screw it up too badly last time I was here, and for that I'm very grateful. You know, it's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous because, well, once you'll hear my story, you'll see why. You know, I was invited to leave places. I was not invited to come and partake in what other people were doing. And, you know, I was joking with Noah. I was going to start at the very, very beginning because I have, you know, such a long time to speak. But, you know, I was born in 1980 and to a couple that was, I know, you know, so you can do all the math, I give you that, I know I like to do that sometimes during the meeting, the math on the speaker, but, you know, and my parents at that time loved each other very much. I was provided for, you know, everything I could want. I lived in a home that my dad and his friend had built, on, you know, in a house that was filled with love. I was given every opportunity to succeed. I have a younger sister. We were in every activity you could ever possibly think of to put your child in. I mean, I was, I took ballet, tap, and jazz. I was a Girl Scout. I was on a jump rope team. I was always in a drama camp over the summer. I was in Girl Scout camp, horseback riding camp. At one point I took a semester of baton twirling. You know what I mean? If it was available, my mom signed me up for it. I played multiple sports, multiple instruments. Church choir, school choir, you know. So if love and activities were enough, I would not be here. You know what I mean? Like, really, I was afforded every opportunity to succeed and find something that I excelled at. And you know, I excelled at a lot of those things, actually, and I excelled academically. I scored very well on standardized tests. I was put in gifted and talented classes. And some of these things I did very well at, but they never fixed it. You know what I mean? That wasn't it. And I couldn't have told you what it was. I just knew that I looked at my peers even in elementary school and felt like there was something different. There was just something off that was different from them. And I couldn't have explained it or told you. But I just never felt like I fit. This is all looking back because at the time, I had always felt that way. So I didn't have a comparison of to feel any other way. You know, but it just looked like they had an easier time making friends with the other little girls and boys, and they got along better. They seemed to know how to interact with each other, and I just felt like I missed that day in, like, third grade when they handed out that manual on how that all worked because I had no idea, and I felt completely ill-equipped to, like, deal with life. And, you know, even in starting in towards middle school, I started to get into a little I call them nuisance behaviors. You know what I mean? Like, I would go in the library and, like, mess up the science projects, you know, or whatever the case was. Like, just, I don't know why. Maybe it was, like, the thrill of getting into a little bit of mischief. But I've always been drawn to, I call it the push the red button behaviors. Like, I really have a strong desire to push the red button. And I'll try to get away with those kind of behaviors. So even before I took a drink, I was already up to no good. Gosh, I probably took my first drink somewhere. I stole my first drink, actually, from my parents' liquor cabinet under the guise of that I was, like, finishing the sparkling cider from New Year's. So it was somewhere after New Year's. And instead, I would go to the liquor cabinet because I'd seen them drink. I'd seen them have parties. I don't know about you. My family had the dusty shelf, like, in our pantry of all the, like, half-drank bottles of different stuff. I remember, like, black and white scotch, and I saw the pictures and the, like, black and white dogs on this one and the pictures on these and, you know, like, a half inch of dust on all of the bottles. And just, I don't know what my idea was about it, but it was definitely something that was not for me, so I was very interested in it, and naturally. And so, you know, and I don't remember, like, getting super drunk. I remember probably feeling a little giddy and happy and thinking, like, oh, okay, I see. But I was still, like, too young to really get into all that and just sort of filed that away. And that was probably, I was 11 or 12 at that time. I really got into starting to drink and on a more regular basis my freshman year of high school. I had picked up smoking over the summer with a couple of my friends, and so I would meet these other kids at the smoking corner. I don't know if your school had one of those. Mine did. It was, like, this corner where the where the school met here, and so you could peek around both sides and still somewhat be protected in this little alcove. And, you know, those kids seemed to be, like, drinking and doing other things and just seemed really exciting, and they seemed not to care what other people thought. And for me, that was really difficult, actually, because I was constantly in my head. You know, I was constantly thinking about what you thought about me. I would, you know, walking down the hall at school, I have, you know, a whole conversation in my head about whether I should say hi to you. You know, like, what if she doesn't say hi back? What if we're not friends? What if, you know, and vice versa. We would have a conversation, and I would feel like maybe it didn't go that well, and I would play it over and over in my head about how it should have gone and what I could have done differently. And so I was really just in this, like, madness and hamster wheel going at all times, well before I ever took a drink. And drinking solved that for me. I drink so that that goes away. You know, and from my first time, well, you know, from when I really got into my drinking, like, I live for that, you know. I take a drink and, like, kind of turn your head and the whole world kind of shifts, like, a half second behind and then comes into, like, full technicolor focus and everything is, like, good and right. And if it's not, it's going to be right tomorrow. We're going to work that out. Don't you worry about a thing. It's going to be great. And I don't care what you think about me, and I don't care if I'm good enough, pretty enough, smart enough, whatever the case is. I feel good in my skin, and I can be present. You know, I'm here in this moment having a great time, and that wasn't happening when I wasn't drinking. And you know, I went from over the course of, you know, that few years. Well, what happened was I had to start protecting my drinking very quickly. I am not a functional alcoholic. That's not, if I'm in my cups, everybody knows about it. And, you know, I'm not good at, I'm not a good liar in that respect. I'm not good at keeping up appearances. And so I started, I mean, even within the next couple of years, having to, like, throw cards on the table to, like, keep you away from my drinking. So right around that time, my freshman year of high school, my parents separated. They divorced when I was in my junior year. And so around that time, I'm really starting to get good and into my drinking. And but teachers would start to ask questions, or people would start to say things. And I would just, you know, be like, things are very hard at home right now. My dad's not there. You know, and I would play that sob story. If you got really kind of interested in what was going on with me, I would start crying. You know what I mean? I would tell you whatever I had to tell you so that you didn't really look any further into what was going on with me. Cause at that point I stopped even caring. Like, I would show up to school in my pajamas, like, drunk or high. Like, I did not care. You know, I would, like, throw on some sneakers and go. I would just need, like, the attendance credits at that point. But I mean, I went from, taking multiple honors classes, having a great GPA, to, my senior year in high school, I was taking classes the second and third time just to graduate on time, because I could no longer show up. It was no longer important. Sports were no longer important. I stopped playing field hockey. I stopped doing a lot of choirs. I stopped doing a lot of these things because I had to hold up. Am I going to be able to, like, drink how I want to, or am I going to show up for field hockey practice after school? Which one is it going to be? And, we all know that, you know, drinking is a much more appealing option at that point. And, you know, so I gave up all of that willingly. You know, drinking didn't take that from me. I made that decision very easily and very quickly that this is more important to me and that's what I'm going to do. And I wouldn't have told you that at the time, but that's really what the case was. And, you know, I barely graduated high school on time. And at that point, I knew I was not going to go to college at that point. So I did what every good alcoholic does, is I got a job in food service. Because I'm not someone who can make a paycheck last. I'm not really, you know, I will blow my whole paycheck in one night. And so I need cash every day. I need a schedule that allows for me to sleep in and sleep my hangovers off. And a group of people that like to do what I like to do. And for the next couple of years, I did my best to do that. But it was probably only, like 2.5 years after I graduated high school that I got to AA, not willingly, but, you know, over the next couple of years, I really dug my life into the ground. You know, I started out at that food service job, and what happened for me is I just slowly stopped being able to show up and being able to put any kind of appearances together. I got into doing some other things because I could show up while I was doing those. I played sort of mad chemist of, like, maybe if I can wake up a little bit or come down over here or do this. And I still wasn't 21, so I sort of had to do what I had to do in that respect. But I was already trying to manage and control my drinking, even from, you know, 18 years old, 17 years old. And I really was already in this, like, it was no longer a lot of fun, I guess, even at that point, because I was having to manage my interactions with others. I was having to manage how I showed up and, like, came off and whether I could make money. It's like, I laugh. It's like the Dr. Bob story. Like, I can either drink or I can make money. Or I, you know, and if I don't make money, then I'm not going to sleep tonight. And, you know, that whole cycle continues. And so it was like that. I'd really have to manage my day, manage myself. It became very exhausting. And by, let's see, probably June or July of, probably 99, only like a year after I graduated high school, I started not being able to support myself. And so I found a boyfriend, and he had a job, and that was great for me. And, you know, I would sit at home and drink and occasionally have a job. But I, at that point, was almost incapable of holding a job down and, like, performing in any of kind of way that would manage to keep that job for me. And, you know, I lived with that guy for a little while, and even he got done with my drinking, and he was a drinker. I liked that. I was like, this guy drinks, and he has a job. This is going to be great. And I, you know, I left there probably this about a year later, summer of 2000, and I had to go back to my mom's house. And at that point, I was 80 pounds and yellow and dirty and gross. My drinking is not glamorous. I mean, when I'm drinking like that, I'm really into it. I'm not washing myself. I'm not washing my clothes. I'm not brushing my teeth. I'm not taking care of myself in any way. I'm really just living to drink. And if I could stay drunk 24/7, that would be how I lived. To not have to come to, you know, there's that part in the big book that talks about, you know, coming to, and, you know, the actor, the alcoholic being very much the actor and putting on this stage character, and then waking up and, you know, being horrified at the events he barely remembers. And that's kind of like how it was. If I could just stay drunk enough long enough, I wouldn't have to face my behavior and the way that I was living my life. Because I had, funny enough, I had these little moments of, like, clarity that would, they would, like, blip up for a quick second. I remember one of them is I managed to get a job at a hotel at one point. And I remember looking in the phone book about, like, rehabs for some reason, and I looked at them, and then I shut the phone book and put it away and just, like, was like, that's excessive. You know what I mean? And I had several moments like that throughout my drinking where I would have an idea that maybe my drinking was a problem, and then I would brush it under the rug. And you know, what happened is when I came back to my mom's house, it's very apparent that something is incredibly wrong with me. And physically, mentally, in every aspect, really. And I think I had at that point, like, one bill. It was for, like, $180 a month. You know, it was not a lot, and I was unable to pay it. I was unable to pay, like, the one bill that was in my name. My mom, I think, was paying my, it was the 90s, so I think I still had a pager. I think she was paying, like, my pager bill and, like, my car insurance, and all I had to pay was my car note, which was, like, $185 or something. And I could not pay it. And that started the first round of an intervention, you know, which is awful if you've had one. My mom took me to the health department, you know, which is a good time. And it's great there. You know, and my dad and stepmom met us there, which was even more awesome. And you know, it, and I'm like 80 pounds and yellow and unhappy and just like, And I'm having to have this interaction with the three of them and a counselor who is sure they know what my problem is, who I don't believe at all, you know. And it's decided that I'm going to go to an outpatient detox. And I went to an outpatient detox in Baltimore, which I'm actually really impressed that I finished, honestly, because it went right past some of the spots that I used to stop at to get some other things. So, you know, I had to drive past that to get to the detox, and I would show up and take my little packet of pills and go home, and I white-knuckled that for for a couple of weeks, I think, maybe. And, but what happened is that I'm an alcoholic. And, you know what I mean? Like, a packet of pills and, like, a stop in to see somebody for 5 minutes doesn't do it for me. It's never going to do it for me, you know? And I got restless and irritable and discontented. And I felt like I had cabin fever. I was really doing, I don't know if you guys have this down here. We call it blockbuster sobriety. And it's where you, like, you go to the blockbuster and you get some videos and you go home and you sit in your mom's house and you just watch them. That's it. And then you go back to the blockbuster and you return those and you get two more and you watch those. Yeah. You just don't drink. You know what I mean? And it's awful. And I did that for a little bit. It just, it's not working out, you know? And I did what I do. You know what I mean? I returned to drinking because that seemed to be the only thing that provided the comfort that I so desperately needed. And, yeah. And that was, gosh, probably September of 2000. And I went back at it for another, here's what happened. I went to a meeting of another fellowship, right? Because the big book says, I will find any reason that I'm not alcoholic. And so I would tell you that those other things were the problem and that drinking is legal. And that if I can just get those other things away from me, that I can drink like a lady, which has never been the case. I've never had one. I don't know what that is about or why I would think that, but that was the rationalization that I had. And so I showed up at a meeting of another fellowship, and there was a guy there. And he had money, and I had a car, and he was on house arrest, so they let him out for meetings or whatever. And so we would back off to the races. I would drive us wherever we need to go to get wherever we need to get. And what happened during that time is within a very short period of time, I called that guy's house, and he had overdosed and died. We had gone out the night before, and I dropped him off back at the meeting. That's where his mom picked him up, because that's, you know, how I live my life. And you know, I called the house the next day, and he had overdosed and died. And at that point in my life, I could not even, like, feign the appropriate emotional response for that situation. You know what I mean? I couldn't even pretend to, like, have an emotion that matched that event. At that point, I really didn't have many emotions. It was usually, like, indifference and full-blown rage. Those were, I think, the two that I had left at that point. And, you know, and I justified it. You know, I was like, well, if he had done this right or that right, or he didn't know what he was doing, or, you know, whatever the case is. And I think I left that funeral and was, like, back off to go to the city. And, you know, I had no kind of thought process that would say, like, maybe take a look at this. And that was in October. And by December, I was back to rehab, because what happened is I was completely incapable of sustaining that lifestyle at that point. I was unemployable. I was hacking in Baltimore City, which is it's basically being like an illegal taxi. So somebody, and you pull over and you pick them up. And it's incredibly dangerous. It's not a good job. It's never a good idea. But I did what I had to do at that point, and I thank God that nothing horrifying happened to me. I certainly got, you know, into trouble. Like, I had given a hack to this couple who was, like, stealing stuff from stores and then selling them to pawn shops. And they pulled my tag number. So I got stopped at one point. This is a funny story, actually. I told Noah there were no funny stories. This one is kind of funny, actually. I was kind of proud of myself at the time. But this is, like, how I was living. So I'm you know, done all the hacks I'm going to do for the day, got what I needed to get, and I'm pulling into my neighborhood, and I get pulled over. And the cops pull me over, and they're like, hey, your tag number, blah, 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 can we search your car? I said, sure, no problem. None of that stuff's in my car, right? I don't care. And I was like, do you mind if I smoke a cigarette while you search the car? And they're like, yeah, sure, where are your cigarettes? I'm like, they're in my purse. And they just, like, eyeballed in the purse and then handed it to me. well, I'm winning right now because everything I had that was, like, remotely inappropriate is in that purse, and they just handed it to me. So I just sit on the curb, and I'm just laughing to myself as, like, the cops are searching my car, and, of course, there's nothing there. But that's how my life was. It was, like, seconds and inches a lot of times from like, getting arrested and getting I did get arrested one time, actually. funny story. That was a different story. But I was drinking, actually. It was sort of a wrong place, wrong time situation. My boyfriend at the time was really into four-wheeling and off-roading his truck and that kind of stuff. And I went with him and a bunch of his friends to do this, and we made a bonfire, and I'm drinking, and I don't care, whatever, do whatever you want, you know. And, well, turns out that not only was this private property, but this was also a place where people who would, like, steal cars and got them and set them on fire, where they would do that. So they saw the bonfire and, like, swarmed the whole area. I was found not guilty of all charges. Still, another seconds and inches. Those charges were trespassing and malicious burning. sounds cooler than it was, but sounds like I was up to something, but I really wasn't. But, you know, that's what my life was like. It was like seconds and inches from really getting into serious trouble, really having something awful happen. And I don't know. My dad has a saying about it, but I won't say it from the podium. You can ask me about it after the meeting. It just popped into my head. But, you know, that I had that some sort of luck, alcoholic luck, whatever you want to call it, where it was seconds and inches a lot of times from something awful happening to me and me having no kind of appreciation for that or ability to recognize that and just, like, stumbling onward in my drinking. And, you know, like I said, about 2 months after that guy overdosed and I was back off to the races, I wound up in another detox. And you're going to love this one. Thinking about all my decisions is so funny to me. So I decided that some of these other things were my problem during that detox, so it would be okay if I just smoked crack. And so I would detox off everything else, but I would just smoke crack to get myself through this detox, which makes no sense now that I think about it. But at the time, it seemed like a great idea. And I went into an inpatient rehab, Reality House in Laurel. And I was there, I think I figured out about 2 weeks. But what happens to me, you guys, and I know you may not believe this, but, you know, when I am sort of forcibly sober, when I'm sober through no, like, means of my own, really, and I'm in a place like that, I'm nasty. I'm really not friendly at all. I'm a nasty, nasty person. I don't use nice language. I don't give you nice looks. I can tell you what you can do with your chores. I will cuss you as soon as look at you. I'm ready to fight. Whatever it takes so I don't feel as bad as I feel. Because in that situation, it pretty much feels like I'm just churning glass, you know what I mean, on my insides. Like, broken glass is just, like, moving its way through, just like I'm walking through a cheese grater. And there's no way that this can be what this is about, you know. And this place or you people are the reason that I feel this bad and I want out and this isn't okay. And so when you behave like that, the people at the rehab really don't want you there. And, surprise, surprise. And they asked me to leave, and rightly so. I broke all their rules. I was disrespectful. I was nasty and vile and violent and, you know, and they asked me to leave, and good for them, because I was not helping anything there, you know. And, and this is sort of like the what happened, I guess, portion of my story is that, that night I went out drinking with my sister and her friend, right? Because drinking's not my problem. It's all this other stuff. Now I can go drink what I really like. And I was just drinking straight liquor. It was straight Jack Daniels night on this one. But here's the problem. We went out to this under 21 club so my sister and her friend could get in, whatever. I'm just happy I'm drinking, you know. And like I said, I'm drinking straight Jack Daniels all night. And we get to this club, and I have this thought. And it says that I'm as physically drunk as I could possibly be right now. Now, if you're an alcoholic of my type, the problem is that you had that thought. which means that you're actually fully not present and that your mind is still running, the hamster's still on the wheel, and the madness is still in full effect. And, you know, I was like, that's not a good sign, you know, and what are you going to do with a thing like that? I just remember feeling really depressed and defeated about that, but I'm out and I'm going to try to have a really good time. And on the way home, my sister wrecked her car end over end off an on-ramp into a drainage ditch from 695 to 95 and totaled her brand-new cherry red Camaro that I love very much. You know, the car was so mangled that her friend crawled out the trunk while the car was upside down. I broke my window on the tumble down the hill. She climbed out over me, my sister, and is yelling at me to get out of the car. But you know what? I kind of just want to lay here for a couple minutes. You know what I mean? And that's what my drinking looks like. You know, and some gentlemen showed up and cleared all the stuff out of the car, all the paraphernalia, all the bottles, all that stuff before the cops can show up, which is why I call them gentlemen, because if you drink like I drink, that is a gentleman, you know? And a cop showed up. It's a scene. You know what I mean? They want to take us to the hospital, but my sister's under 21, and if they breathalyze her, that's going to be a problem. You know what I mean? She's driving that car. So, and she's ready to fight about it. You know what I mean? With state troopers. And if you've met my sister, she's even tinier than I am. So it's actually kind of funny to think about. But, you know, our mom came and picked us up and took us home. And again, it's just a night where I feel defeated. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not really getting any relief. Bad things are happening. Again, more. You know what I mean? The close calls are not so close anymore. And I get a call the next day from this kid that I had been in rehab with, and he asked me what I was doing. I told him I was trying to go to the city. You know what I mean? Because I have safety glass cuts from head to toe. I've broken a window, like, with my face. Things are not going well. Like, I'd really like to just get out of reality for a little bit. And he's like, sure, no problem. But we got to go to this meeting first. And I was like, okay, that's fine, right? Because I'd been to meetings before, and I'd, you know, politely, you know, if I was really bad, I would share and cry and leave before you could help me. I would, like, emotionally vomit on the meeting to get a little bit of the madness off, and I would leave without letting you anywhere near me. And, you know, so I was like, sure, no problem. Well, he and his sponsor, who actually Noah sponsors and is still sober, they came and picked me up and took me to a meeting called Saturday Night Special. And, straight there, do not pass go, do not go to the city. And I was too heady, I guess, or prideful to, like, say anything about it. Like, excuse me, why are we not going to the city? I just was like, I should just keep my mouth shut and we'll see how this works out. And so I had been spending a lot of time in Baltimore. So I was kind of dirty and grimy. I had, like, Timberland boots and, like, baggy clothes and, you know what I mean? So I walk into this meeting, and this meeting is in Chevy Chase. So it's, like, reasonably nice neighborhood. And I walk in and I immediately judge everyone. You know what I mean? I get there a little bit late, so I have to sit in the back on the floor. And actually probably everyone was dressed like we're all dressed tonight. You know what I mean? In clothes that were clean, that matched each other, like brushed our hair, brushed our teeth. And I saw that and I was like, there's no way these people know where I've been and what's going on with me. You know, I thought, you know, this looks like a Country Time lemonade commercial. This must be nice for you guys. But this clearly, you clearly don't know what's going on with my life. And there's no way that you can help me. And, but what happened is, somebody, probably Noah's Pigeon Todd, shoved me up at halftime to get a 24-hour chip. And, after the meeting, and I didn't want to look bad. My pride was like, fine, I'll just go get the stupid chip. You know what I mean? And, but after the meeting, all these women surrounded me and asked me for my phone number. And I sort of felt like, I don't know about this, you know what I mean? But it didn't occur to me to lie at that moment. I don't know why. I lied every day. But in that moment, it did not occur to me to lie. So I gave them my mom's house number. And women started calling me, and they, you know, they all Todd and the guy I met in rehab took me at, like, a party at someone's house that night, and I hung out with people very uncomfortably, certainly feeling very awkward, but I was there. And I've been coming to AA ever since. It took with starts and stops, and, you know, women started calling me, and I started going to meetings, and I got a sponsor, I still wasn't convinced that this was the answer, but at that point, right around that time, my mom kicked me out, and I had to move in with my dad and his new wife, you know, and at this point, I'm 20 years old, but now I have, like, a curfew and, like, all these other rules and stuff, and not really into that, so now I have to, and AA was my way out of the house. If someone would pick me up and take me to the meeting, I could leave. So I became very interested in that, and, because I wanted out. Because my stepmom didn't work, so I would have to sit at home with her all day and, like, clean the house and stuff, and at that point, that was, like, the last thing I wanted to do, really. And so I would go to the meeting, and I don't know, man. I mean, people say they caught alcoholism. I'm definitely an alcoholic well before I came here, but I caught on, you know. I defogged a little bit. I started just kind of hanging out with people, going to the meeting, going to coffee, going bowling, you know, all of those things that we do that I thought were so lame. I was like, well, I'll just go because it's better than being trapped in my dad's house. And I started listening and I started relating to people. And I started, you know, working through the steps. The first sponsor I had, I did not keep. She drank shortly after I got her. I don't think that has anything to do with me, but I was like, okay. So I got another sponsor, and we started working the steps, and I remember I lived very far from where the meetings were, and so I got to drop off everyone, like, past a certain point. You know, like, they were all the people I got to drop off on my way home. So I would drop all these people off, and I would call my sponsor's house. We had house phones then, so weird. So I would call her house phone, and if she wasn't there, I'd talk to one of her roommates, but I would just talk to her the rest of the way home, and she would let me piss and moan and cry, and whatever I had to do, she would talk to me all the way home so I could, like, get home to my house. And, God, we just did this, man. I mean, I was thinking today, like, what has the last, you know, 13, almost 14 years looked like? And then I was like, talk about the mistakes that you've made. And I have not done this perfectly. I will be the first person, probably many other people would love to tell you about it, but I have not done this perfectly. You know, I generally have a bad attitude, you know. But here's the deal. And I was thinking about this too the other day, because my class, the class of 2001 in my home group, started at like 50 people. It started at 50 people. Now it is less than 20, you know. And I was thinking, what have I done that's different from what these other people have done? Because I'm certainly not a nicer person. Like, I'm certainly not, you know what I mean, any better suited to do this than they were. You know, some of them, whatever. And I think probably better suited than I am to help other people and do this than I am. Whatever my attitude has been, I have sat in my sponsor's living room and kicked and screamed and yelled about, I'm not doing this. But you know what? I have sat down and done it. And however bad attitude, whether it takes me 6 months to write it, I have always in that moment chosen to do the work here. I've been through, several sponsors. The next sponsor that I have, was not an alcoholic. She left AA, and I ended up with her sponsor. That sponsor died, and then I had another sponsor, and that didn't work out, and I have my current sponsor today that I have, but I've had to go through those changes in AA. I've had to, make those changes and be a grown-up enough to know when I need to make a change for my recovery, and I've had to do that. I don't like doing that. I'm someone who is fiercely loyal. I want to stand with you to the end, like to the better end. And sometimes that's not really what's best. And I've had to make those kind of decisions. I've been incredibly sick in sobriety. I've been hospitalized in sobriety. People have shown up for me here. People have come to my house and done my laundry. They've come to my house and watched me instruct them on how to make the cookies. You know what I mean? Like just they have shown up. And then on the flip side of and I've had family members die. My cousin died of an overdose in an abandoned building while on pre-release. You know what I mean? In jail. So this is you know what I mean? Like those kind of things have happened, and I've gotten to show up for those things. Like an adult, you know what I mean? Which I never want to do, you guys. I want to kick and scream and have my way, as much as I can, you know, but those are situations where you guys have taught me that that's not what it's about. And that's not, what I get to do. But on the flip side of that, I've had really awesome things happen. You know, my sister got sober when I had 18 months. Well, finally sober. She had her own fits and starts, but you know, she got sober, and we got to have a relationship. You know, we got to make amends with each other and be, like, best friends. And, you know, I was in her wedding. I'm the godmother to her daughter. You know, and I was telling Noah, because I was thinking about, you know, what is it that I talk about, you know, these years of sobriety. And I was talking to him about, I was at a meeting, and you know, everyone seems to be talking about, like, that they had made amends with their parents and, like, they were now, like, best friends and it was awesome and we love each other. And I have to sigh at that a little bit because that's just not my experience. And if it's your experience, that's awesome and I'm so happy for you. I don't get that story. You know, for me, my mom has some mental troubles and she's never been diagnosed, so I'm not going to tell you she has one thing or another, but she's certainly a little... whatever you want to call it. And so I don't always get that. You know, I get crazy phone calls sometimes about things that, like, have never happened or, you know what I mean, whatever she's decided is going to happen today. And, but I still have to show up for that. And that's a whole different level of work in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I've had to go through writing inventories and writing letters that I never send and, showing up again. Which I never want to do, you know. You guys have taught me how to do that and suit up and show up and not scream at her and cuss at her when she's being crazy and love her the best way that I know how. So if you have that story, I relate to that 100% because that's my experience too, is that I don't always get, you know, the happy ending. I don't always get... you know, butterflies and rainbows and sunshine. Sometimes I just get to keep doing more work. And I don't know why all of this is happening tonight. This is not normally my normal MO when I speak, so that's a little weird for me. But, you know, I get to have those relationships. Like, I have a relationship with my dad today, like, where we're kind of friends. You know what I mean? And I was talking to Lynn before the meeting, like, he's cool again. Like, there's that point where your parents aren't cool, and my dad is cool again, and we get to hang out, and I go over there and have dinner. You know, I have real friendships with people where, it's not dependent on what they can do for me or what they have right now or what they're willing to share with me. It's based on this. And so when times are good, I show up. When times are bad, I show up. I've gotten to take awesome trips. I mean, I've gone on, some trips out of the country. Our group has some people that go to, like, Costa Rica during January, so they'll be leaving soon. I've been on that trip many times, and I've got to have sober memories with other alcoholics where I can go somewhere and have a great time, and I don't have to worry about being alone, you know? And I guess that's what all of these stories are sort of about, is that I don't have to do anything alone here. I didn't come here tonight alone, you know? I have never done anything alone here. Like, the work is hard. You know, they say it's a simple program, but it's not easy. I mean, I have some, like, midnight crying, kicking on the floor inventories that I've had to do and, you know, sitting up and bearing witness with other people about whatever they're going through, what I'm going through, but, like, this is the real deal, you know? Like, I would have missed it. Like, left to my own devices, I would never do this work. I'm someone who longs for a shortcut. Like, always wants to, like, get someone else to do it for me. Like, what if I just give you $5? Can you handle that for me? You know, like, I'm always kind of shucking and jiving and, like, trying to find the hustle to not do the work. You know, and that doesn't really work here. You know, it might work in, you know, but that's another thing I've learned. I don't get to take shortcuts anymore. You know, I used to shortcut my whole life, anything I could find a shortcut on. And today I just, even at my job, like, I just show up and do the work that they pay me for. It's crazy. I have a job. You know what I mean? And I have, like, keys and a security code. And, like, it still baffles me sometimes. I, like, get to work and boop, my card works. And I'm like, oh, you know? that was never my case. I was always, like, being, like, shuffled out the back quietly. Like, don't cause a scene. Like, just get out of here. We'll mail you your check, you know? And, like, I never thought I wanted to be a productive member of society, like, and just show up like everybody else and, like, do a job, you know. I remember going home some nights at the time when people were, like, getting up and going to work, you know what I mean? And I would look at them and think, like, there's no way, you know what I mean? Like, there's no way I'm going to do that. Like, that's crazy to me. And I could not understand, and yet at the same time, there was something that, like, longed for that, like, life, you know, and I get to do that today, you know. I get to show up and do the work and hopefully try to help other people do the work and help God's kids get done what they need to get done. You know, it's not always fun and it's not always glamorous and, you know, but we get to do this here. And I forget that so many times, and maybe that's the message today. It's funny. For the meeting, I prayed, as we're wont to do sometimes before we speak, and I always pray that I not look good. You know what I mean? That it's not about me looking good, so maybe this is what all this is about tonight. Because it's not about me, and I sometimes want to, like, get up here and be really eloquent and, like, tell a good story and, you know, engage you and, and instead, I don't know what this is tonight, but really it's about me sharing my experience so that hopefully someone relates and that we stay sober tonight. And that that's really my only job here, is to stay sober and help somebody else hopefully achieve sobriety. And yeah, so I'm sorry, I'm going to close early anyway, but thanks for letting me share. Oh.